I'm a reporter. I'm coming to see
He's a pretty social guy.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the regular meeting of the California Regional Water Quality Control Board, La Hontan Region. My name is Don Jardine from Martinville, and I am the chairman. This evening, we are meeting as a subcommittee of the board. We'll be able to take input and give direction, but we will not be able to take action. I want to thank members of the public for coming to our meeting. We do a better job when you participate in the issues that come before us. At this time, I would like to introduce the other members of the regional board. Dr. Amy Horn from Truckee. Peter Pomfrey from Bishop. Keith Bayes from Rosemont. Right now, this evening, Eric Sandell is unable to attend due to work obligations, and Jack Clark from Apple Valley is ill.
You said it. That's all that needs to be said.
But they're good, dedicated board members, and I know they wanted to be here. I wish to introduce our executive officer, Patty Koo-Young-Jin.
Thank you. Hello, I'm Patty Koo-Young-Jin, and this is actually my very first board meeting as an executive officer, so happy indeed to be here. I just wanted to clarify on the agenda.
I think people can't hear
can
you.
Can they hear me? No. Right. I'm Patty Koo-Young-Jin. Good evening. This is actually my first board meeting, so I'm happy to be here. I wanted to just briefly clarify on the agenda for everyone that items 7 and 8, these are waste discharge requirements for Antelope Valley Landfill and for the Barstow Landfill, will be postponed till July, so we'll take that under consideration then. And also to mention that the South Tahoe Public Utility District emergency sewer line repair will be delegated to me because of quorum reasons to sign that so they can proceed with their construction. But I also wanted to take a moment to introduce some of our staff that are here today. We have Sue Genera, we're here, our board secretary, Kim Niemeyer, our office of chief counsel, Laura Kemper is in the front row there, our assistant executive officer, Chuck Curtis is in the audience there from our Tahoe office, Mike Plasiak is just back today after a long time away from the board. Lisa Durenbach is, I believe, in the audience. Ann Holden is here. Cindy Mitten is here. And Tim Post is here as well, who will later on be giving you a presentation. Thank you.
The regional board will be considering many items during this meeting. Although we must use our time wisely, we encourage your input on any items so that our decision will be based on all available information. If you wish to speak on any agenda item, please fill out an orange card indicating which item you wish to address and how many minutes you'll need. Although we do not administer an oath in most proceedings before this board, we expect all statements made before this board to be truthful, with no attempts to mislead by false statements, deceptive presentation, or failure to include essential information. We also ask that you obey our ground rules, which are: treat everyone with respect. This includes board members, board staff, anyone who testifies, and your fellow citizens. This means no personal attacks and no violent, contemptuous, or disruptive behavior. In the interest of everyone's time, please communicate your ideas clearly and efficiently. So that we may develop an accurate administrative record, we ask that you speak only after you are recognized. At that time, please come to the lectern and speak to the agenda item. If you do not follow these rules or become repetitious, I may ask you to sit down. Any person aggrieved by any action or inaction of the regional board, including but not limited to the issuance, modification, or rejection of waste discharge requirements, administrative civil liability, or a cease and desist order, may petition the State Water Resources Control Board to review the decision. The State Board must receive the petition within 30 days of the regional board's meeting at which the action was taken. Board staff will provide you with copies of the regulations about filing petitions if you request them. They are also available on the State Water Resources Control Board's website. First item of business is public forum. Is there anyone who wishes to address the Lahontan Regional Water Quality Control Board on an item not on the agenda? Yes, sir.
I did fill out a speaker card. It's there in front of you. My name is Norman Diaz. Most of you know me here. I could talk about PG&E, but I'm not going to do that today. Unfortunately, I'm here to talk about something else, something you guys know well. It's about the nursery product sludge facility outside of town here. And we've been fighting this project for 6 years. We came to this board. We came to all boards. We chased this thing around through every agency that had to regulate it. And we understand that only one agency, the Board of Supervisors, approves it. The rest of you just regulate it. I understand that. But when we came to you, we asked for help. And when we went to all the boards, California Integrated Waste Management Board, the Air Board, the Solid Action Waste Task Force, Fish and Game, Fish and Wildlife, we went to everyone. The most help, and I think the most support we got was from this board. And I want to thank the staff of Lahontan for listening to us and putting out that information and giving you that information. We submitted thousands of pages of documentation to you on the problems we thought this process had, and especially on the applicant that was applying for this permit, nursery products, sludge facility that's going to be hauling sludge out here. You denied our requests for enclosure, but I do think you did some strong regulations that would be make it safer. We weren't satisfied, but it would have made it safer for us as a community living downwind and downstream of this facility. I don't know how to say this now, but everything that we said has come true. This applicant has now started the process of hauling sludge into his facility without the proper approvals. Most importantly, under my opinion, no cleanup bond and no closure bond. So basically, he's operating out there, and he can now walk away, leaving us, the community of Hinckley, and the taxpayers to clean up his mess. Now, I found out about this just by driving by there and seeing it. Where is all these people, all these agencies, the Air Board, the Fish and Game? Everyone said, don't worry, Norm, we're going to take care of you this time. It won't be like he was in Adelanto, because in Adelanto they had a horrible history. You remember all this. I don't have to repeat all this. And here we are. No cleanup bond, no final closure bond, no bounce the muck off the truck grate at the gate. Everything's inadequate out there. But they have started hauling sludge in there. And in my, I don't think that they are even using green waste. I think they're just hauling sludge. It's just, it's a dump. They make their money hauling sludge in. And so we came to you and we said, help us with this. And so last week when I was going out of town for a job, I went by there and sure enough, there's a window out there of sludge a couple hundred yards long. I tried to call your agency. The first time ever, I didn't get any call back from anybody in your staff. I finally hunted down somebody, and she said, yeah, we know they're not approved. Don't take it personally. I didn't get a call back from the Board of Supervisors. I didn't get a call back from Land Use Services. I didn't get a call back from Health Department. So now what are we going to do? They're hauling sludge in there. It's a hazardous waste, especially when it's not mixed with green waste. And they're not approved. Someone needs to go lock those gates and shut this down until they at least get that cleanup bond in place. I'm told by your staff that that's not really what you can do. That's not your job. And that's what everyone's going to say to me. They're going to send some paper to him and say, please stop. Please, please take away your mess. We had him in a debtor's exam. One of our pro bono legal attorneys is owed almost $500,000, 400 and change in legal fees owed to that group. We got him into debtor's court. And in my opinion, he has $1.4 million in debt and $7,000 in the bank. He had to open. He can't afford a closure bond. He has to make money. And yet what you're going to do is send him a letter and say, please stop? That doesn't work for the community of Hinckley. We don't live on paper. We live here in the air and the ground, and now this guy's the emissions and the dust and everything that we came and warned you about is happening. And he can walk away today and just go declare bankruptcy. What are we going to do about this? Somebody needs to do something. I can't do anything. I'm just a citizen. Somebody, some agency, has got to shut that gate and stop him from accepting waste until he at least gets the bond in place to close and clean it up. What else is not in place? That's only two things I can just from driving by that I can see other problems. There's problems at that facility, and it shouldn't be open. And we all can agree to that, I think. But what is the next step? And I've talked to some of your staff, and again, I love your staff. You've been the best agency to us in the 6 years. But now we have a problem, and we told you this was going to happen, and it's happening. It's happening today. They're allowed to open 7 days a week, 14 hours a day. They can haul sludge in there, and the community of Hinckley and Barstow is who's going to pay. And it is a water quality issue. It is an air issue. It is a people issue, and something needs to be done. And I hope that you guys will take some action and make it strong action. And I understand you can't go out there and handcuff them and lock the gate, but it seems like you guys can do more than send him a letter and say, please stop.
Norm?
Thank you.
I thank you for your input. And we will get back to you.
Can I respond? If I could follow up on that, Norm, we are aware about it. We've actually been having some discussions about that to see what we can do. I want you to know that we are going to do our best to try to do something about that more than just send a letter. I have a personal interest in this because I wrote the original compost regs for the state of California many, many years ago. So I think working with our friends at CalRecycle and other agencies. But I just wanted you to know you take your concerns very seriously, and we are going to be looking into it very seriously.
I have three other speaker cards. Naz?
Yeah.
Oh, hang on. You want to speak to item three on the agenda?
No, public comment.
Oh, you want to speak to public comment?
Yeah.
Please step forward.
I guess my situation is similar to Norm's. It's what's happening on the ground over there. PG&E, I heard they were buying both my neighbors, and I knew once my neighbors are gone, my place is going to be broken into because I don't live there full-time. I only go there on weekends. And sure enough, as soon as that house of the Mullinex was removed, my house was broken into once, twice, and three times. I basically trashed the place. They smashed the window, removed fireplaces, cut the cables from the walls, etc. And finally now, I either had to abandon the place completely, or finally I leased it to someone, fixed it up as best as I could, and leased it for next to nothing. It's either that or it's going to disappear completely, because that's all the cops can tell me, is eventually they're going to remove everything in there of value, copper, wires, everything. So this is number one issue. And I go talk to them about purchasing the place. I got 20 acres. I got a few thousand feet of underground water. I was planning on putting trees all around the 2,000 feet of water. I got a two-bedroom, two-bathroom house. And they come over and they offer me $60,000. After all the dragging and so on, we're going to buy it. That's not its market value. I says, why don't you pay me as much as you pay for my next-door neighbor? Compare it to that. That's what should be the comps are. They're comparing my place to Newberry Springs, a place I don't know. I don't think he can buy a place with 20 acres and all that replacement cost that I've been building this stuff for years. Now it's worth nothing to them. Now they're coming in and saying, we're going to put the well. Again, I have to drive all the way to Barstow and probably is going to end up with nothing. They're dragging their feet. They're not doing anything. So if you guys want to tell them, okay, we want to buy your place, or buy it, pay fair market value for it. In comparison to my next door neighbor that was 200 feet away from me, why do I need to make comparison or have comps from Newberry Springs? It doesn't make any sense to me. And how did they achieve that $60,000? I have no idea. They go and hire their own appraisers. And if they wanted to have a water well, there can be a functioning water well in that property within 2 or 3 weeks. Now it takes a few weeks to have the first meeting and another few weeks to have the second meeting. I wonder if they ever, or they ever intend to have any wells on that property at all. I think there should be some kind of enforcement, and I don't know who to turn to. I mean, there should be time limits. If they're going to put the water well, and they done feasibility study, and they say my property is good for water wells, fine, come and start.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I can't really respond, but is there someone from PG&E who would respond?
Good evening. My name is Cheryl Bilberry. I'm the director for the Chromium Projects for PG&E. And I walked all the way up here just to say that we can't discuss personal property acquisitions, but we are happy to follow up with you directly, and we'll do that.
Thank you.
I would just add that we do, in our amended order, have a time frame that they must follow now for putting in the providing the replacement water. So that there is a time frame in our new order.
How long do they have?
Under the new order, August of 2013 is by the time all of it has to be in, but definitely there's going to be things happening before that time period.
That's way too long. I mean, that's over a year from now.
I'll go ahead and then we'll move on to item 3. I thank you for your input.
Thank you.
Excuse me?
Chairman, there may be some more cards for public forum. I'm not sure. Are there not? Maybe they're going to wait and talk after the Chromium study is kind of speaking.
I have two other comments, cards, and Darren Banks, and that's regarding PG&E.
I wanted to talk to you guys a little bit about the Community Advisory Committee. And the first thing that I'd like to discuss is, number one, I've been to a lot of those meetings, and essentially what has happened is it's turned into completely opposite of what your intentions and what the community of Hinckley intentions meant it to be. It's basically turned into a PG&E meeting ran by them. They do the agendas. They have somebody controlling the floor, somebody controlling the table. The discussions are guided by them. People are cut off without really being able to speak their mind. And essentially, they spend most of their time pushing their propaganda, which was complete opposite of what this advisory committee was supposed to be. It's supposed to be a committee put together that can come decipher all the smoke and mirrors and the lies that they push to both you guys and us, and what's truth, and explain it to us so we can make, you know, some logical decisions on what we want to do. And it's not that way at all. And the Lahontan people have been to the meetings, and you can ask them personally. They'll tell you. I could go into specific times where I can tell you that they lied about this. So, also the CAC has the community advisory committee has closed meetings away from the public to discuss items that deal with feasibility studies and other things, you know. And it may be with the CAC and Mr. Webster and the two PG&E board members, but they're not supposed to be having meetings outside of the committee, the community. We're supposed to be involved, and we want to know what they're talking about and doing. That's that is dissension right there. It's not, you know, it's not going to make us feel any better about how you guys were supposed to set this committee that was, we're supposed to feel good about it and getting correct information. The consultant, Project Navigator. I don't necessarily have any problem with the Project Navigator. I do have a problem with the way they are paid. Okay, the money comes directly from PG&E. They're on a short contract. Okay, then at the end of this short term, which is coming up soon, PG&E gets to decide whether or not they're going to continue his contract. Okay, and if you guys don't know how much their contract was, you need to find out. Okay, because they're getting paid a lot of money. Okay, to be our advisor, to be the people who we're supposed to trust and come in. So, how is a person or a company or a corporation supposed to be able to come in and do their job properly when the people who are paying them, they have to worry about their contract in a few months and whether or not they're going to receive a contract? You know, and so the appropriate way is, number one, I think the way that the advisory committee, the whole idea of it, I think it's a good thing, it's a positive thing, but the whole concept needs to be revamped and changed. Okay, we need to make PG&E give the money to Lahontan into a fund and allow Lahontan to make that decision on the contract or pay the person. PG&E needs to be kept completely out of it. And then the way that they talk to, or essentially what this, the whole thing this came down to, is really for them to show their true colors and have, in some ways, intimidate the community. Okay, and what they come across as, they're telling us, oh, this is what we're doing for you. We're doing this. We're doing that. We're gonna give you guys whole water replacement, and it's taking away from what the whole thing was meant to be. It's a complete sham. And please, I request that you guys take a look at the way that this committee is set up and revamp the entire thing, so that the money goes to Water Board and the Lahontan Water Board have a seat up at the committee instead of sitting PG&E front and center. Give them a seat at the table, but don't have them control the meetings.
Okay. That's all. This actually goes to sit under. Oh. Do you have a question?
Rod, can I if what you say is true, then in my opinion, PG&E is being very short-sighted. In my mind, the most important goal of the Community Advisory Committee should be for the community to trust the information it receives and the solutions that are arrived at.
Absolutely. And you know what, ma'am, the sad thing of it is that it's actually...
You need to come back up to
Before I came here, I took my family to eat across the street, and they happened to be meeting there. So
the things that they were discussing in that with PG&E, representatives of PG&E present, although being part of the board, yes, but present at that meeting and discussing the strategies, I think it allows PG&E to guide the course and the actions of how the CAC reacts or makes requests to you guys or address things. You know, it's not appropriate to have them involved in any of that, which is what has happened and which does happen. Okay, the people who are our consultants should not be discussing, should not be talking about how things should be or whether letters should be written or what they need to do to get the Lahontan or you guys to agree with what they're saying, and none of this should be happening. You know, the entire process, although purpose is good, has been completely used by PG&E, as they do most of the time.
Darren?
I mean, yes?
I want to thank you for your comments.
Okay. All right.
I have a follow-up comment, which is I have had some training in facilitation and conflict resolution, and one of the basic principles of that field is that the facilitator of a process should be completely neutral.
Absolutely.
And before the CAC was set up, I made some phone calls and found some names of neutral facilitators who live in San Bernardino County. I don't remember now exactly where, but, you know, people who are skilled in managing processes like this and could be employed to help run the process. And I don't know what we can do to make that happen, but that is really the skill set that's needed more in addition to this consultant that's been hired.
I agree, but
we need a technical consultant, and we also need a completely neutral process person running this process.
I agree, and somebody representing the water board should also be sitting on that committee.
Well, it's either both. I mean, this is something for a process person to figure out, and I don't know what the answer is, but it's either both Lahontan and PG&E are involved in this process or neither is involved in the process. And I don't know which it is, but it's imbalanced to have one party involved and the other one not.
Ma'am, you can speak to the Lahontan people that go there. They will tell you probably a lot of the similar things I'm telling you. They're not going to disagree with me, I don't think. So, please, I request that you guys do something.
Thank you.
What more can we say at this point?
Well, we can't run the money through Lahontan. I know that for
sure. Okay, maybe you need to say that so everyone can hear that.
I don't have a microphone.
We cannot run money through the Lahontan.
Yeah.
Yes, but there is ways that money can be set aside for different...
Not through us, though. We've looked at different ways. We cannot take that money in and then we do it out. There's just limits by the state of California on what we can do with that.
There could be a separate mediator from the state. There has to be some type of...
You'll have to.
Let me maybe offer a suggestion that we could at least explore a bit further. It's true, we cannot run the money mechanically through the board. It's complicated budget issues. It's just mechanically too difficult and untimely, I should say, to get it done. But when I head up the Kettleman investigation, we did something similar where we were able to find some contract funds and hire a facilitator to run the meeting. So let me work with our staff and see if there's a possible way we could be of assistance and get back to you.
I'm sorry, but you have to get up so we can get it on the recording.
It's just not appropriate for PG&E to pay the guy, be in control of his contract, and then be able to determine whether or not this guy is working with the community of Hinckley. You know, that's not appropriate. That makes no sense.
Darren, I accept Patty's commitment to research this.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It's just, I'll set it for the next person who steps up. You have to raise it up and down, depending on the height of the person.
I have one other person, John. If you could give your name.
Yes, my name is John Quass. I'm part of the CAC. In fact, the four CAC members that hired our technical advisor are all here in the room. And Ian Webster was hired by us, not by PG&E. The money that was put aside for his hiring was put in an escrow account. We have an oversight committee, which happens to be us four, that deal with any complications dealing with rising of payment or any type of squabbles or disagreements that might come up. Aside from that, though, the one thing that I really wanted to talk to you about tonight is the CAC is highly disturbed about your new order from the executive board and dealing with the feasibility study. Number one, we were told that there were not going to be any more negotiations that the CAC was not made a part of. And this, once again, was done in secret between your executive people and the PG&E people, and is issued to our surprise, and which we have some major disagreements in it. Paragraph 3, Section A, we feel is very important in the original order that you folks handed out, or that the executive board put out, and we do not like to see that deviated from. We feel it's very important to protect the community, and that Section 3A needs to stay put and be adhered to. Also, the timelines given to this. I'd ask that there be no order dealing with the voluntary program. And yet this order is saying 120 days, dealing basically with 25 people that are in the plume that have above background levels, that their units, if they choose the voluntary program of having water purification put in, that that has to be installed within 120 days. And then going till August the 31st of 2013 for the other 300, in which we feel that the 300 should have been addressed in the first place. The timelines have a tendency to complicate things. And the more we look at it, the more it looks like there needs to be a permanent water system put in using these temporary systems only as a temporary fix, in which we know they're going to visit them within the next 5 years to look over their feasibility. But that in order to completely and permanently decouple the community from the bad water, it looks like a permanent water system really needs to be installed. Although we know to start on it today, it's going to take 4 or 5 years to get it all through the permitting process. Looking at the amount of money that it's going to cost to put in these temporary units, and I've been given an amount of $60 million plus, you know, it looks like a lot of money has been thrown around. It could even be bad money, but we need to be decoupled from the plume immediately. And the sooner the better. But I think that while that temporary fix is being done, that they ought to be, there should be some order to get a permanent system put in, piping treated with a central treatment unit, and get this water to these houses in there permanently. This thing's going to go on for another 30 years to clean it up. The more we look at it, technically, it's just getting to be a nightmare. And people in our community, due to a lack of education of what's going on, don't realize the harm of the way that they're in. Others are running on a rumor mill. A lot of different things that go on. And some of the accusations that are made about the CAC and about our private meetings, and yes, we do have private meetings without PG&E, in which we get with our technical advisor and we talk things over in order to be able to better educate the community in our meetings. Now, sometimes in our open forums, we have disturbances by people in the crowd, in which the CAC has not been able to receive the reports from the proper people that were on the agenda to give them to us. They're interrupted by the public, and we've had to move on simply because they're not allowed to talk. And so somebody asks you, why do you have private meetings? That's why. Sometimes to get those reports that we need, we have to do it. But our community, our CAC, was formed by PG&E. And so we're there to advise PG&E, and we want to be able also to advise Lawton, as well as our community, and also to get feedback from the community and give it to those governing bodies that that need that information. But it's a lot of trial and error. It takes a lot of time. But we're there to help. But I do want to emphasize that 3A definitely needs to be revisited, and that your order that you've just put out tends to suspend that. And I am bored. I'm asking you that to take a look at that. 3A does not need to be suspended.
Thank you. Is anyone else from the public who wishes to address the law? Yes, sir.
My name is Tim
Winsor.
I'm the IRS.
Okay. on an item not on the agenda.
My name's Ian Webster. I am the IRP manager for the Community Advisory Committee for the PG&E cleanup. I am the so-called guy that was referred to by Dan. A few words in general about my mission, just to be clear, so you guys can go home with an understanding of what my mission actually is. I am not beholden to PG&E. My goal for the community is to, as I say, separate fact from fiction. I was hired back in February, and I have a pretty well-defined scope to review documentation that's prepared by PG&E, interpret it for the community into terms they can understand, and to also kind of guide the community towards responding to PG&E initiatives that could be protective of human health and the environment in the Hinckley community. So I take my role very responsibly, very importantly, and we have a imperfect process of meetings that go on. I'm not saying they're perfect, but I'm willing, with the advice of PG&E and also the community, to try and amend that process in terms of community input. But I think we have a healthy, robust system that tries to solicit input and then take action upon it. So that's my general remarks about the community process that goes on. Facilitation, could it help? Absolutely. So any advice you can give us on that, I'd be happy to accept.
You need to hire a professional facilitator is what you do. I mean, there are people that is their profession, and particularly in a situation such as this, which is very complicated and is going to extend over a long period of time, you need to have somebody who's fully engaged in the process, understands what the issues are, know when certain issues need to be brought up, the sequence of addressing issues, what information to get out in advance. I mean, there's a lot of administrative details that go with being a neutral facilitator and doing a good job of running a process such as this one. And it really needs a professional facilitator that's doing that work.
Understand. Thanks.
Yeah, I wouldn't. If I were in your shoes, I would not be trying to do it myself at all.
Well, I don't want to stand here and say that I try and facilitate single-handedly these meetings. There's a lot of teamwork goes into it to try and get the right information at the right technical level distributed to the community. And there are professional facilitators involved actually in the process. Admittedly, they are on the PG&E payroll.
Yeah.
But
that's the problem.
Yeah. The other remark I want to make, just for the record, but very quickly, is two remarks, if you'll just stay with me, is that there was no private meeting tonight between PG&E and the CAC. That was myself meeting with my CAC clients to discuss some of the comments we might make tonight, such as John Quast just made. And my final most important remark is regarding general community acceptance of one of the most pivotal important documents that's arrived in the scene. As you may know, a feasibility study for whole house replacement water was submitted by PG&E in April, a draft feasibility study. The universe of that analysis covered about 17 to 25 homes within the core of the plume. Jump to today, the Water Board has issued an amended order June 7th, basically accepting the feasibility study and making slight modifications to the original order that enforced the original whole house replacement work. Mr. Quass, who's one of the co-chairs of the CAC, indicated that paragraph 3A of the original order has been suspended. The community is concerned about that. We've originally, about a couple of months ago, on behalf of the CAC, I submitted a letter basically saying that 3A was one of the most important teeth that the letter could have. It concerns the speciation of natural chrome 6 from Mad Main chrome 6. It's an important part of the order. We think it requires to remain in the picture of the solution of the Hinckley problem. Second remark on the order in general. The previous executive officer, Harold Singer, was most concerned about community acceptance of the ultimate whole house water solution. It was surprising the speed with which the whole house water alternative was ultimately selected in being ion exchange / reverse osmosis. There are other alternatives out there. We would hopefully respect that the Water Board would still accept comments from the CAC and our opinions in the feasibility study. We've got two concerns mainly, and PG&E already knows about this. I've talked with them verbally about it. The universe of homes that the feasibility study was conducted on, arriving at the solution, was only 25. In reality, there are possibly 300 affected residences out there with the Chrome 6 problem. So conducting a FS with a universe of 25 homes and applying it to 300 requires some further explanation. And point number two is we're asking for PG&E to become slightly clearer on their ultimate decision-making process when the MCL for Chrome 6 is adopted and or the five-year point is reached. So far, the comments from PG&E are that all data will be reviewed. We've written in our comments that we'll submit to you tonight some language that we think might be more appropriate that involves looking back to today's feasibility study and updating it into the future. Kind of a five-year review to decide where the program grows in the long term for the overall community. I know that's quite a bit within my allotted time spot, but these comments are codified in a letter that under CAC member's signature we'll submit to you tonight. Thanks for your time. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Any further public input? There being none, I'll move on to reports. Item 3, statistical analysis of background chromium groundwater subset data, Pacific Gas and Electric Company's Hinkley Compressor Station, San Bernardino County.
Good evening, Chairman and members of the board. My name is Lori Kemper, and I'm the Assistant Executive Officer with the Water Board. And tonight I'd like to introduce Ann Holden, who will be providing the bulk of the presentation tonight. But I wanted to start with just a quick chronology and a little background. Yeah, Dom's going to move. Okay, first I wanted to let the community and the board know that the purpose of tonight's discussion is really we're responding to a specific request that was made by members of the community to conduct a different evaluation of some of the background water quality data that was previously collected by PG&E.
Just a minute. Can everyone in the back hear?
No. Usually my voice is on the microphone. Okay. I could probably. Is that better?
Just use it. Okay.
Hey, that is a lot better. Okay. All right. So tonight, the purpose of tonight's discussion is really, it's about sharing information. And we are, Ann Holden will be providing information in direct response to a request by several members of the community of Hinkley to take a different evaluation, a different approach with some of the background water quality data that was previously collected by PG&E for the background study in 2007. So, briefly, I wanted to just cover some of the main actions of the board prior to where we are today. So, in 2008, most folks know that the Water Board adopted a cleanup and abatement order that required continued cleanup and removal of hexavalent chromium from the groundwater. That order in an amendment later in 2008, identified maximum and average background chromium concentrations, and that order also required that PG&E prepare a feasibility study to consider several alternatives for completing cleanup to the background concentrations of chromium. That report was due to the board in 2010, and we received that and shared that with the public. During much of the year of 2011, PG&E made a number of revisions to that feasibility study based on comments received from members of the Hinckley community, as well as as well as staff from the Department of Toxic Substance Control and US EPA, and also the Water Board staff. Water Board staff directed PG&E to make those changes. And during that year, 2011, I think we have a better feasibility study now that hastened the overall cleanup times. And that's the basis of our environmental document that we are now working on. We have been working on since 2011, and we intend to have that out in the public's hands in about a month. In addition, during 2011, Water Board staff continued their oversight of the cleanup of groundwater in the Hinckley Valley, required additional cleanup. PG&E expanded agricultural treatment units and their in-situ, their underground treatment units. And the other thing that occurred in 2011 is that community members requested that the Water Board revisit the 2007 background chromium study, and at the Water Board's direction, staff had independent peer review, and we've covered that information in past meetings. Anne's going to go into that in a little more detail. And then the other thing that the Water Board was involved with during 2011 was a couple of cleanup and abatement orders related to requiring PG&E to provide, at the beginning of 2011, bottled water to all those affected by the contamination, and now, as we've heard a little bit tonight, the voluntary program proposed by PG&E, as well as our order that required that individuals affected by the contamination receive whole house water at all their taps that would be free from hexanol and chromium. And so with that, Anne is going to cover the information on the statistical analysis of background chromium.
So which is it, Pam?
This one, Fullerton.
This one, Fullerton.
Mm-hmm. And I believe this is your Victor.
Okay. No. But that's Fullerton. Okay.
Good evening, Chairman and members of the board. My name is Ann Holden. I'm an engineering geologist in the Water Board South Lake Tahoe office, and I'm here to discuss item 3, which is statistical analysis of subset data from PG&E's 2007 groundwater chromium background study report. Lori mentioned that we have existing background chromium values in the Hinckley Valley, and those were adopted by the Water Board in November 2008 in a cleanup and abatement order. Those values are 1.5 and 3.2 parts per billion total chromium, and hexavalent chromium average and maximum values are 1.2 and 3.1 parts per billion. And those numbers were adopted based on data in PG&E's 2007 background study report. And that data was collected in 2006 over the calendar year. The Water Board uses these background values to define the chromium plume in groundwater and to assess remediation progress. We also use them to determine cleanup levels for groundwater in the Hinckley Valley and to evaluate cleanup alternatives for the environmental impact report that's forthcoming. They're also used to define the affected area where PG&E is required to provide replacement water in the cleanup and the whole house water cleanup and abatement order that was just amended. So some recent history of this item. In March of 2011, the Water Board requested peer review of PG&E's 2007 background study. This was in response to public concerns that the Water Board heard at a meeting having to do with two basic issues having to do with the addition of wells that were added after the second quarter sampling event that were clustered in one specific area around a well that had some higher concentrations during the first two sampling events. And also the fact that the plume had expanded since the study was done, and it led the public to be concerned that the sampling locations might have sampled waste chromium rather than natural background conditions. So Water Board staff over the summer of 2011 had the 2007 background study peer reviewed. We got the results of that in October of 2011. And the peer review comments can be summarized into four general categories that were critical of the quality of the laboratory sample analysis procedures, the type of wells that were used for the majority of the background study sampling. These were long screened agricultural or supply wells that were screened over both aquifers rather than just targeting the upper aquifer, which was the intended target of the study. One of the peer reviewers questioned the statistical methods and assumptions that were used to summarize the data and come up with those calculated average and maximum values. And then also uncertainty in determining past chromium plume migration was an issue. So just this past February, PG&E released a new background study plan in response to those peer review comments. And also 25 Hinckley residents, as Lori mentioned, requested a recalculation of the background values using just subsets of data from the 2007 background study. And that letter is in Appendix 1 of your agenda item in Enclosure 1. So at the March 2012 board meeting here in Barstow, following a discussion of the peer review, the Water Board directed staff to consider recalculating the background values using subsets of data from the 2007 background study, and also to work with the Community Advisory Committee and other experts to continue reviewing PG&E's new background study. So moving forward on two parallel tracks. So the reason why we decide that we're recalculating the background value using data subsets is because this approach had the potential to address three main peer review comments. And those comments were the questionable lab quality control data. We had the opportunity to pull that data out of the original whole data set and just look at a subset of data that didn't have that questionable data. Also, the wrong type of wells used for sampling, we were able to consider wells that were only screened in the upper aquifer, and then we were able to revisit the statistical assumptions that were made. Also, we had the potential to address public concern over bias about the wells added after the second quarter sampling event. So the subsets, what we did was we took the whole data set that was presented in the 2007 background study report and first pulled out all those sampling results that had the questionable lab quality control data. Then we developed data set number one, which was the data from wells screened only in the upper aquifer. And then a second data set was developed, which was data from the wells that weren't added after the second quarter sampling event. And then we asked Dr. Neil Willits of UC Davis Stats Lab to evaluate those data sets and see if he could come up with a statistically valid background number. And I'm going to show a picture here of what those the locations of the wells that those data sets came from. So this is data set number one wells. These are the upper aquifer only wells. There's three of them over to the west, and then there was one more that would be located right about here, so just a southeast and up gradient of the plume. So there were only four wells in that data set. And then data set number two, those are the wells that come up in the red triangles, and those are all the wells that weren't added after the second quarter sampling event. So there are, I believe, 18 wells, and you can see they're distributed pretty well around the study area. So when Dr. Willits looked at data set number one, and that's the wells that were screened only in the upper aquifer, he concluded that there were not enough data to calculate a background value. So that data set didn't yield any results. Data set number two, there were enough data points. There were about 66 sampling results from that data set. So Dr. Willits looked at the data distribution basically by graphing it, and he looked at that to determine the best statistical method that he should apply to those data. And he concluded that after he looked at the data that there was not strong enough evidence that the data had a normal distribution, which in statistics means it's a bell-shaped curve. So that was the conclusion that PG&E had come to when they looked at the data. He did not come to that conclusion. He used a different test that PG&E did, therefore. And I wanted to mention that this is the same conclusion that Dr. Rubin, who was the statistical expert peer reviewer, came to when he looked at the data. So Dr. Willits used an upper prediction limit instead of an upper tolerance limit because he felt that was a better choice, and he came up with a 95% upper prediction limit on data set number two, and that's in essence a new recalculated maximum background estimate. For total chromium, the number is 2.7 parts per billion, and for hexavalent chromium, the number is 2.5 parts per billion. And this is less than our currently adopted values of 3.2 and 3.1. So that the plume that's drawn on the maps, if it was to be drawn with the recalculated subset values, would change, and I have a kind of cartoon of what that would look like. So the red dashed area in this slide here is just the EIR study area, just for context, and then the blue line is the fourth quarter 2011 plume boundary that's based on the 3.1, 3.2 adopted background values. And then the yellow things that come up over here, these are kind of a cartoon of potential plume changes. And I want to be clear here that what I did was I just drew circles around any well, whether it was domestic or monitoring wells, that would be over the recalculated subset data. When PG&E draws the plume on the maps, they only use monitoring wells. So this is including domestic wells. About 13 additional domestic or monitoring wells in the west and about 5 in the east would be over the maximum background estimates of Dr. Willits' subset data. So I just wanted to show that picture so you could see sort of what it would look like, but it doesn't expand the plume to the whole valley. So staff proposals is to retain the existing background values that we have for now, the currently adopted values of 3.2 and 3.1, rather than consider adopting the recalculated subset values. And there's three reasons for this. The subset values that Dr. Willits made the new estimates for still represent mixed aquifer waters because the first data subset that had only upper aquifer wells was too small to use. So this new value doesn't overcome one of the main criticisms of the peer reviewers having to do with mixed aquifer, upper and lower aquifer data. We're currently working with staff of the USGS and also Dr. Webster with the Community Advisory Committee to review PG&E's February 2012 new background study proposal. That, at this point, is our best chance to address all the peer review concerns as a new study using properly constructed monitoring wells. And we're also working with the State Water Board to try to get a contract in place to hire the 2011 peer reviewers to give us technical input on the new document. So that's all happening as we're speaking. And also the expanded whole house replacement water cleanup and abatement order. All homes in the affected area with detectable chromium get water. Maximum background is not the trigger for replacement water, so that does provide some alleviation of concern for many residents regarding the background value. So moving forward, recount the subset values that Dr. Willits calculated could be considered in the future if, after we go through reviewing this 2012 background study, if we can't resolve the main challenge, I think, that we're going to face in this study, which is the uncertainty over historic plume migration and determining sampling locations to represent background conditions with an acceptable level of confidence. If we can't, if there's just too much uncertainty around that, we need to really carefully consider the value of doing a new background study, and we may want to revisit these numbers at that time, but we should let that review go through. So the next steps would be to carry out staff's proposal or modify it based on any direction we get tonight. We're busy preparing for the release of the draft environmental impact report in July 2012. including tentative site-wide general waste discharge requirements. That would be the permit that would go with the EIR. And I would come back and provide a status report on the background study review in September to the board and the public. And I'm happy to take any questions.
Dr. Horn, do you have any questions? Peter Pumphrey, do you have any questions?
I do have one question that refers to the document that was in the board package. It was just the meaning of one little phrase that's in there. It is in the recommendation section where water staff recommend that the upper prediction limits calculated by Dr. Willits for background chromium not be considered for adoption in the near term. And I was just wondering what the near term meant.
So the near term would be while we're still reviewing PG&E's 2012 background study, and once we conclude that review and can make some decisions on the value of moving forward with a new study, that's sort of the near term, and I'm hoping that sometime this summer.
Well, thank you. That clears that up completely.
Mr. Diaz.
Yes.
Oh, sure. I believe it is.
And you indicated that data set number 2 had a sufficient number of samples for a statistically significant study, and I believe that's 66, but data set number 1 did not.
Correct. Data set number 1 had 13 sampling results, and in Dr. Willett's view, that was not enough to calculate a statistically significant maximum background value.
Would that problem be solved by continued rounds of sampling?
Yes. If we were to sample just the upper aquifer, and that would be one of the focuses of the new background study, if there is to be one, is that we would generate enough data focusing on the target aquifer, which would be the upper aquifer, using properly constructed monitoring wells. And we would collect more than 66 data points so that a new number could be calculated.
And do we feel that the problem with having wells screened across both aquifers is that the samples would include some lower or higher numbers from the lower aquifer?
You know, it's hard to know because most of the wells, we don't have any well construction details for, so we just don't know which aquifer those samples represented. Were they mixed? Were they upper? Were they lower? In general, I believe the lower aquifer has non-detectable levels of chromium from the data that we have.
Was it ever considered to simply sample from the lower aquifer?
I'm trying to recall if PG&E's new...
What is that?
Is that on, or is it this? Is it my nest? Okay.
That could be considered in the new background study.
Just hold it farther away from your mouth.
Okay.
I'm going to stand over here. That could be considered in the new background study, looking at either aquifer, the upper or the lower.
I know that with a lot of contaminants, arsenic for one, concentrations tend to rise with depth.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if chromium does that or not.
I think here chromium actually reduces with depth. Yeah.
Okay. I have no more questions. Thank you.
One more question. When you talk about a new or additional sampling effort, do you have a sense of how much time it would be required to obtain those samples that would be that would give a degree of confidence?
I think at PG&E's study, they estimated it would take about a year after the study plan was approved. Because we collect data for the 2007 background study, we collected data over the entire calendar year of 2006. So usually they try to do a quarterly sampling event over an entire year to capture any seasonal changes.
Thank you. And I'm sorry, I said I only had one question, and I guess I lied. And I'm not sure if this is a question or it's a comment, but in reviewing the material for tonight, the concern I had, or the thought that I had, was that I'm not certain that an answer in the sense of a number, a clearly defined number, is findable because of a variety of things that are sort of alluded to, especially in the document that's in the board package. And that has to do with passage of time and movement of water and, as we talked about this afternoon, more movement of water. I guess I'm trying to ask you if you can tell me, and I can understand if you can't, if you can tell me a degree of certainty that you have as to whether or not this chase is actually going to produce a result.
That's a good question, and that speaks to my bullet point about the notion that historic plume migration is the biggest uncertainty. All the other issues that the peer reviewers brought up about lab QC or improperly constructed monitoring, those can all be addressed pretty readily, but we can't go back to 1950 and find out what the water quality was. We don't have great information going back that far about historic pumping rates and other things in the valley agriculturally related to determine past groundwater flow. That's going to be the biggest challenge with these technical reviews of PG&E's background study. And that's why we're asking a lot of people to look at it. Not only us, but the CAC, the USGS, the 2011 peer reviewers, because if we can answer that question with an acceptable certainty, and I don't know what that would look like, what that certainty would look like, then we need to really think about redoing, you know, is there any value-added benefit to redoing a study?
Okay, thank you. I think anything else I have is just a comment.
No more.
Okay. How about our executive officer? No comments. Thank you. Is there any response from PG&E on this matter?
Thank you. I'm Kevin Sullivan. I'm a remediation engineer with PG&E. I think in general we concur with the staff's recommendation that at this point it'd be advisable to get the technical experts together and let's look at what we can come out of with the background study. In our mind, there's a couple of key facts that you need to weigh into that decision. And I have in my pocket some of the data that I presented in March if we want to look at that. But number one is, there are wells that with a pretty high degree of certainty, and I believe the Water Board staff has agreed, we can see our upgradient of the plume that have had chromium concentrations above 3.1. Okay, so there's a certain amount of variability there, but these are elevated concentrations. Number two, we have the Isbicki study, John Isbicki, the USGS scientist who noted, in a similar aquifer about 50 miles away, that there's a very pronounced spike, if you will, of chromium that occurs not only in the upper aquifer, but right at the water table in the upper aquifer. So we believe that, if we're going to define the plume based on 10-foot wells that are screened right at the aquifer, we need to do a background study with, kind of 10-foot wells. Let's just get the ruler right if that's the way we're gonna measure it. And there's a lot of good scientific literature about that. And I acknowledge and I agree with Ann's observation and the concerns expressed by one of the board members that, we're going to have to take a hard look at what we know about historical pumping, what we know about historical gradients, and what we don't know. And I would, you know, ask that the board give us time to go through that process, and let's see what the, you know, what the experts have to say. And again, our view is that we're working really hard on final remedy, which is largely independent of this question. And with the idea of the whole house water provision, we've tried to create an environment where we have time for the science to be done to answer this question in a proper way once and for all in a peer-reviewed, you know, manner, so that we can see where the data and we can see where the science leads us.
Are there any questions from board members? Dr. Horn?
I don't have any. Go ahead, Dr. Horn.
Well, I just have one, Dr. Horn.
One simple question, which was, I mean, the estimate of it taking 1 year to redo the study, collect the data, once the study plan for redoing the background, in my mind, 1 year sounded like a pretty optimistic estimate, because wouldn't new wells have to be drilled and, you know, analyses have to be done and all that? I mean, that's going to take more than a year once if the plan were accepted to go and the decision was made to go ahead with that.
Yes, I agree. I would suggest there's a tension between in the science between taking the time to dot every possible I and cross every possible T, sample for four quarters through the year. You know, I think we'd really want to hear from independent technical people. Could you do that in less time? Could you do that over, say, four samples in 6 months or something like that? There may not be seasonal variability. I'm hesitant to suggest shortcuts, and I think we're very open to a public, you know, review process, including the IRP manager, including the USGS, including the, you know, the other staff, and let's, you know, let's throw it up there for, you know, kind of a jump ball and balance those things. But I agree. I think our proposal was, let's go out, install wells. That takes a couple of months. Sample for a year, and then interpret the data. So I suggest that the start to finish time is probably something closer to 2 years for that to get a good, solid, reliable answer. But there are probably legitimate hydrogeologists who would perhaps disagree with that and say you could do it faster.
Mr. Pumphrey, are there any questions?
I don't have any questions. I have a couple comments when it's appropriate, but no questions.
Mr. Diaz, any questions?
No, thank you.
I have no questions.
Thank you.
Any comments from the public? Yes, sir.
If you have documented or tests from...
Can you please state your name for the
record? My name is Darren Banks. If you have tests that were done at certified labs showing that wells, or even done by the Water Board or PG&E, showing that wells on the what they consider outside plume as being non-detect, and now we see in the last 5 years or 10 years or whatever that may be that they show chromium 6 and at a gradual increase, can we assume, I'm just asking, it would be an assumption that that's part of their chromium and that's part of their plume, which PG&E doesn't consider that because they've allowed to say, well, background or natural is 3.1. And by them allowing to be able to say that, they're not even considering the outside edges. They're just, that's not our chromium. And if you have proof that you have none, and then all of a sudden you have a gradual increase, and you do have some, I don't know, maybe science would say different. So.
Thank you.
So the plume needs to be defined.
Lori, could you respond?
Yes, this is Lori Kemper for the record, and what Mr. Banks brings up gets a little bit to what Peter was asking, whether there's a findable result, and I think it's really important to remember that the board is not required to pick a number for background chromium. There is no single value. I think the board in 2008 use the best information at the time and identify the maximum background as well as an average. And I think in that decision, the board recognized there was a range of values in the valley that were considered background. So by identifying a maximum and an average, there was definitely acknowledgement that a range existed. And as Mr. Banks points out, you know, we know that there's lots of water in the valley that is at non-detect. Even today, there's lots of water in the valley that's at non-detect for hexavalent chromium. So that is something that we are looking at, and in terms of this new study, at not necessarily making a decision, or as Mr. Sullivan from PG&E mentioned, that we might make a decision about identifying background at the 10-foot depth level in the shallow aquifer. We might, but we might want to identify background at several depths in the upper aquifer and maybe do some more confirmation. I mean, I think we have enough evidence now that the lower aquifer is non-detect, and I think even PG&E would agree with that statement, that there's only a limited area right now that has some contamination in the lower aquifer, and it's due to discharges from PG&E. In some ways, we've already identified that the lower aquifer is non-detect. And so any further degradation of the lower aquifer, the Water Board could require cleanup if we found some new areas of the lower aquifer that were affected by PG&E's discharge, for example. And I think our background study that we're looking at proposing in the future would focus on the upper aquifer, and we may decide to look at several discrete zones, you know, 1 to 5. I'm not sure how many zones, but we could actually identify background values for multiple locations in the upper aquifer. I'm talking both by depth as well as spatially across the valley. There may be different values as you move from south to north. So it sounds very complicated. It is. I think we're fortunate to have computers in this day and age that can actually handle matrices and a variety of sets of numbers. It's hard maybe for our brains to do it, but I think we have computers that can do that for us. So that's what I'm looking forward to. And I know that may make it complicated, but it may allow the board to group that data in ways that maybe is a little easier to manage as well for the future cleanup. So you could have different cleanup levels for different parts of the valley.
I have a question for you, Dr. Horn.
And since you're there, how much of the final...
The comprehensive cleanup?
Yes, thank you. Comprehensive cleanup can be done while the question of the background is... level is still open. So when do we need to
have these numbers
to have a closure on what the background levels are? And how much can we do without knowing that?
Well, I think it's maybe there's a multi-part answer to that question, only because I think that in the core area, what we call the core area, where the higher concentrations of chromium are today, so, for instance, the area that's identified by the 50 parts per billion plume line, there's a lot of work that can be done there to maximize the contaminant, you know, the hexavalent chromium removal. The feasibility study and the different alternatives that have been looked at have looked at various, numbers. People have tossed around 40 years to get to, 3.1 or 70 years, depending on what you're doing. But I do think the board has the ability, without having made a decision about the final cleanup levels, that the board can set interim cleanup levels. They could say, for instance, in 10 years, all water must be below 10 parts per billion, as an example, and maybe they can do it faster than that. I do think that for those areas that are already in that kind of very low concentration number, some folks, that's where the board has to decide. Are we going to direct action in those areas that are already less than 5 parts per billion or less than 3 parts per billion? Are we going to direct actions to remove that chromium in those areas? Today we heard a little bit about at least I did on the bus, and I know there was two buses, but there was some discussion about an extraction well that was installed north of Thompson Road to deal with water that was measured at above 10 parts per billion, but most of the water surrounding that area is much lower than that, is in the 2 parts per billion. So right now, PG&E is extracting water there right now. And whether or not they would continue to extract water there once they're measuring water, you know, below 3.1. I mean, these are things that the board can make decisions about without having a final agreement on what's background numbers. But as you get into the lower concentrations, it starts to be an issue.
Okay, I have a follow-up question, which is, what would be gained by this board making a decision about background levels before the Department of Public Health finalizes the maximum contaminant level for chromium-6? As opposed to waiting until after the MCL has been established?
Well, I think there's benefit in that right now we can use the best information we have. First of all, I think the place to start is that the Water Board has the authority to require cleanup of all pollutants that are placed in groundwater back to the level that is considered natural or background. So that authority will exist regardless of a maximum contaminant level. So it's important to recognize that, because that's a unique authority the Water Board has, and other agencies don't have that. So there's no need to wait for a decision on drinking water standards, and the Water Board has the ability. So the benefit in picking a number, say, sooner, is that then it's clear what the objective is, and it's based more on the feasibility of removing the hexavalent chromium in as quick a time frame as possible, and just moving forward on that. We don't need a drinking water standard. The drinking water standard may complicate the decision-making process, but it doesn't have to be relied upon by the Water Board, because the pollution should be removed if it's feasible to remove it.
Mr. Pellick.
Contaminant, I should
no
say.
Questions.
Mr. Gibbs.
Yes, I do, but I don't have
any.
Lori, I think you indicated that there are examples of non-detect in the valley. Are you aware of any examples of non-detect in the upper aquifer?
You know, I don't have that. I know there are areas, and most of those areas are located south of the compressor station, and PG&E's geologists may have that data in his brain better than I do in terms of that. But there is definitely upper aquifer water that's non-detect, but I don't know the specifics of where that is, other than I know that there is south of the compressor station. But the challenge is that some of these wells do go across, you know, both aquifers.
Well, if there are instances of non-detect in the upper aquifer, how can we explain the existence of pockets of non-detect after so many years or decades for opportunity to blend meat? If we assume that there is a background level of chromium above zero.
I might rely on some of my geologists to help me with this if I don't get this right, but I believe you can still have pockets of hexavalent chromium naturally occurring in the shallow aquifer, and maybe it has more to do with the fact that the shallow aquifer moves up and down more with rainfall, you know, high precipitation, so you're dissolving chromium that is contained in the natural soils or the rock formation. So you can have pockets just by their proximity to, say, a formation that has higher chromium in it.
Okay, thank you.
I just had a few comments quickly. I do believe it's important that we get solid science established, some kind of background information, if it's a year, 2 years, and certainly the cleanup should, the impacts of PG&E need to be cleaned up. Are there any further comments?
Well, I would just say that I would not like to see I would not like to see the effort towards the larger goal of getting the cleanup accomplished suspended while we search for what I think is going to be a highly elusive answer to this question about what is the appropriate background number. I agree wholeheartedly that that whatever decisions are made should be based on the best science and they should be based on the best information. But it doesn't take rocket science to know that there's a lot of cleanup effort that should be initiated as soon as possible and pursued with all available possible zeal. So I would really, really hate to see chasing this rabbit keep us from looking at the reason we're out there and what we're trying to do. My only caution would be a couple things. You need, if you think that you may not have a piece of information, then you have to design your strategy in such a way that the piece of information you're not sure that you can obtain doesn't become crucial to any decisions that have to be made down the road. And so the danger I see in this background number business is, A, we may not be able to determine it, but B, at the same time, we might put it in a position of importance which is way exaggerated to our ability to actually come up with the information. So I would just hope as we go along that this stay in some kind of perspective so we know what's dependent on that number and what isn't dependent on that number, and we design a strategy that keeps in mind that we might not come up with the number at all.
I think we all agree on that.
Yeah, let's give everyone a chance to speak if they want to. I don't know, Keith, did you have something you wanted to add before the microphone got passed all the way down to me?
No, thanks.
I second everything that Mr. Pumphrey just said. To me, the most important goal that we all need to keep forefront in our mind is to get on with the business of cleaning this plume up as expeditiously as we can. And I agree, I'm very concerned that we might be throwing good money after bad, chasing a number that in the end, we can never satisfy everybody that we have come up with the number. So the resources should be spent on cleaning up this pollution problem, and I just want to assure the community that I don't want to see this process slowed down at all.
Tip or direction?
Just a specific question. I want to be sure that the board would like us to spend the time to have the current proposal by PG&E peer reviewed. Do you want us to continue that step at this point?
Well, actually, I was going to add, and I thank you for prompting me. The other part of that there's more information that we need before we can make an intelligent decision about this question, and so getting the review from USGS and statistical people and all that, as long as they are in addition being asked whether the uncertainty about water movement in the groundwater over the last 50 years can be addressed through any kind of sampling scheme at all, and I don't have any great confidence that it. I would want to hear from the experts what their opinion is about that, and then I think once we have that additional information, we can make a more informed decision.
Thank you.
All right.
Thank you.
Yes.
Ian Webster, again, the IRP manager for the Community Advisory Committee. In the in the discussion that just took place, I'd like the board to also recognize, perhaps in the search for quick justice, in the attempt to derive an ultimate cleanup number, thereby allowing the remedy to proceed towards that number. The community is concerned about the fact that overall PG&E is obligated to go after its Chrome 6, knock it out basically, irrespective of the fact that background Chrome 6 may exist. You alluded to that fact, that that's a special provision that the Water Board has. A very important tool or paragraph in the original order, the October order, was this paragraph 3A that I referred to earlier. It's a provision that requires PG&E to investigate methods to basically speciate its Chrome 6 from natural Chrome 6. The recent amended order of June 7th of this year, which is associated with whole house water, suspends that provision of the original order. The key word is suspends. There are provisions that would de-suspend it and bring it back into operation. But I'd like the board to consider very carefully that particular paragraph that suspends the 3A component. It's an important part of the ultimate cleanup. So there is a coupling between the search for background and also PG&E being obligated to clean up its Chrome 6. The provision that requires that, an important one, has been suspended.
Actually, that prompts a question of counsel.
That provision of 3A was tied to supplying whole house replacement water. And the idea being that there was below background, we wanted PG&E to identify those wells for the purposes of supplying replacement water, those wells that it had affected. Once PG&E voluntarily decided to supply water to everyone within a mile, within that affected area, we no longer had the ability or felt the need to require them to comply with that provision. So because it was tied to them supplying water and not to the cleanup specifically, it no longer had the same sort of purpose. So what they're doing now essentially takes care of that provision. And that was the reason why it was suspended.
Dr. Holland.
Could you explain why speciating the chromium could not be tied? I mean, why couldn't it be tied to the cleanup problem?
It could, but in that order was specific to supplying whole house replacement water. And also, I would also add that was one of the specific provisions that PG&E petitioned our order on. And so that was a point of disagreement that the state board was considering. That may have been taken up by the state board. So in order to get around that disagreement with PG&E saying we can't do this, and offering instead to provide water to an area that essentially provides water to more people than probably would have been under the original order, it moves the process along faster because we are going around that disagreement. So in the context of cleanup, it may be appropriate to try and look at that, but for the purpose of the whole house water replacement order, it no longer had a purpose.
But that is still out there. As we get more information about whether or not to do a new background study, and if that doesn't work, maybe some new technologies come forward that make speciating. I mean, that it's still out there that is something that the board could require down the road if and when it becomes appropriate.
The board has the ability under Section 13267 of the Water Code to require investigation. So if we felt that there was this ability to speciate, then it could issue an order requiring PG&E to do that.
Yes, sir.
People might
Sullivan from PG&E. Just to be clear, in our background study, we very much left the door wide open to look at several different means of speciation. That's our desire too. It's a different question, as Ms. Niemeyer said. And so, as part of that background study review, to our knowledge, there is not a at the current time, 100% clear-cut way for speciation, but we definitely think that that should be part of the evaluation, and we'd welcome the input of both the USGS and the IRP manager and the Water Board Review as part of that background study. We think that could be an important line of evidence that helps to sort out some of the questions about uncertainty over water movement for the last 50 years, but that's got to be looked at as a whole in concert with other data. So we're very much in favor of exploring that option. So I just wanted to make sure that everyone was clear on that. There's no disagreement about the potential benefits of speciation.
Okay. Do you have board direction? Nothing more on this matter? Yes, sir.
Darren Banks again. I don't understand the gentleman from PG&E says that, you know, in their background study they have no problem with that provision, but yet they fight. That was one of the reasons that kind of the state water board was unsteady about the whole water replacement. So that does that make any sense? If they're completely okay with it, why can't we continue on with that provision? Because I understand what you, as the board is saying, look, the most important thing is let's get this cleaned up. But in order to clean it up, we have to define it. And PG&E is responsible for all the chromium 6 and the other stuff that they're pumping into our water. We're not talking about the arsenic and the manganese and other possibilities that the process is pumping into our water, you know, the community's water, the people that families, kids are drinking. So it's important to define the plume in order to clean the whole plume up. So it makes no sense not to do that, ma'am, with due respect to your comment. You have to define something before you can fix it. So they need to say, yes, this is our responsibility, or tell you guys, no, with proof, no, it's not. And they can't do that because the plume has shifted so far north, east, and west. They have no idea where it is. It would be much better if you guys can force them to define the plume. Somebody could have common sense can see that the plume line is way further out than where the PG&E map plume defines. And it's important for the community to have PG&E at least acknowledge the fact where the actual plume lines are. So I would like you guys to rule to our concern, not necessarily to theirs.
Well, I thank you once again for your input, and of course we cannot take any action at this time, but I'd like to suggest that you wouldn't mind a sidebar visit with the PG&E and myself.
Sure.
After this meeting, or maybe in the morning.
Sure.
For the record,
My name is Lester White, and I'm a Hinckley resident and Community Advisory Committee member. And I've been doing some surveys around Hinckley, and one of the biggest surveys that the citizens of Hinckley would like to know, has there been a human risk assessment done? Anyone?
I don't know. Anyone on the staff want to answer that? I mean, my understanding and... correct me if my information is incomplete, is that many studies, human health risk studies, have been done. And I think there have been studies done, yes.
Is there any way we can get the results of those studies?
I'm sure there are. Does anybody in the staff have any more information about these human health studies, human risk studies? I mean, Harold knew about them. So I had conversations with Harold about them. Are they in the public record? Have they been done by Department of Public Health or Chuck says yes. So Chuck has more information. Would Chuck come up and talk about it, please?
That's about all I know.
Chuck says that's all he knows. So could someone on staff research that question? And you're on the CAC, is that correct?
Yes, ma'am.
Make sure the CAC gets that information, please.
And also the community would like to know, we've been told that Chrome 6 was tested in laboratory rats to see what the effects would be. And the community would like to see hexavalent chromium, uranium, arsenic, and nitrates combined in a toxic cocktail and give it to the same kind of rats and see what will happen to them. We would like to see that test done.
Well, no, it's a good point. Interactions.
Yeah. I think the only way we have specific information about your specific request, but I do want to let you know, I think we talked about this earlier, that I've reached out to OEHA, our scientific arm agency, whose expertise is risk assessment and whose expertise is these kind of questions that you have, as well as the synergy between the various chemicals. So I'm happy to put you or the community advisory committee in connections with them to have that kind of dialogue. In fact, they are coming to the next community meeting to be there to answer your questions, but we certainly can help arrange to get you together sooner, in addition to finding the information from the Department of Public Health for you.
Well, thank you.
All right.
In that case, I'll move on to the next agenda item. We'll take a 5-minute break and then go on to the next agenda item.
I'll move.
Oh, you know who that is? Mr. Banks.
It's going to be short. Happens. It's going to be short because we don't have much time.
Yeah, we'll go now to Executive Officer's Report.
Well, good evening, everyone. I just wanted to give a few updates and then also mention that Tim Post is here from our Victorville office and will give a presentation on our Barstow perchlorate investigation. And Lord Kemper will also give us an update on our quarterly violations report. So let me start off just pointing out that in the May Executive Officer's Report in your agenda packet, there's a clarification we'll be making to page 415 regarding PG&E settlement agreement, and it referenced a prior directive for PG&E to contain a chrome plume, and we need to clarify that a little bit. So, so let me, a few things I want to give an overview or update to the board on are the state budget. And as we can all see, we don't have a state budget as yet. So I remain hopeful. But to update the board on the proposal from the governor regarding merging Region 7 with Region 6 and with the San Diego Regional Board, that provision has failed, so that is not going to be proceeded with. However, the provision of the trailer bill language that moved changed the board from 9 to 7 did pass, and that is indeed going forward. They have changed the structure of the regional board going forward. There will be now 6 general positions that meet a group of expertise, as opposed to the old way of doing where there was carved out with ag and industrial and one public member. They will be changing this over time as they grandfather, as people leave positions, is how they're going to over time change the face of the regional boards. Another thing that also did not pass was in the governor's proposal was that the governor appoint the chair of the regional board. That will stay as is, where a majority of the board will make a decision both about the chair and the vice chair. Lastly, another thing we'll follow up is that They are asking a report to the legislature on possible future ideas for reorganizing regional boards. And at last talk I had with the state board, they didn't have any different ideas. They may submit the same proposal to the legislature that they already submitted this year, and that is, again, dealing with Colorado River Board. On timber harvesting plans, an update. That still is going forward at the moment. The $30 million assessment on lumber sales to be used for state agencies, including the regional boards, to pay for staff and workload related to timber harvesting and other activities related to timber. So there is a possibility that goes forward that could be an assistance to the regional board. They will extend the timber harvesting plans from 3 to 5 years, as well as there's some issues regarding fire liability costs going forward in court cases, and that's actually probably the most contentious part of that proposal, that if it does not go forward this year, it'll likely be because of that. Also, there's some language added to this year's budget that affects the regional board in terms of the Tahoe TMDL. We've been asked to provide a report to the legislature, updating them with a time schedule for compliance after 120 days after we receive our scientific study on nearshore requirements. So we've asked for that study. It's supposed to come back to us, I understand, in the fall. And so we will have 120 days after that to provide some information to the legislature about our plans, how to implement that in the future. There are also a number of other things added to the trail bill for us that we work with other sister agencies on budgeting, as well as implementation plan going forward on the Tahoe TMDL. I just wanted to just say a word about the cleanup and abatement order that we talked about earlier today, that it was our intent to try to provide a larger group of the Hinckley residents replacement water, and we were hoping to help them in that way. So I just wanted you to know that was our intent, was to help them in that manner. But also looking forward to the comments from the Community Advisory Committee. We will definitely respond to those and welcome those comments. I also want to update the board on the Angora Fire Forum. We are very close to a 5-year anniversary of the Angora Fire. And there will be a forum in Tahoe on Monday, June 25th that I'll be participating in. And I think the staff are going to work together to kind of summarize all the things that we've done in those 5 years. I think it's rather impressive to provide perhaps an update to the committee of what we have done in those areas, from our regional waivers to our various permit streamlining activities. Also, the Senate Office of Research is doing an assessment of all the state agencies that were involved in the Angora fire. They'll be providing a report card of how each agency performed as a result of that. I'm hopeful we'll get a very good report card out of that, because of the 20 somewhat recommendations that came out of that, and 10 specific to the regional board, I think we've completed pretty much all of those. So that is something I'll provide to the board when we prepare that. Another update I wanted to give the board is that the after 25 years, TRPA is finally updating their transportation plans and their regional plans, and we are very actively participating in that process of working with them and providing them comments. And we have actually provided our first round of comments to them. I think you'll be interested in knowing it's very important that that plan reflect the TMDL, not just in how it's referenced, but also in how it's being implemented for the local governments and other agencies up there. So we are very steadfast in working on that, and we're having meetings with our sister agencies. They share the concerns of that water quality is a very high priority in that process, and we've had some initial good discussions with TRPA staff about implementing. In fact, I'm going to Nevada next week to meet with our counterparts so we can submit a joint letter to TRPA that we are in unison in terms of our thoughts on TMDL. So I think that's very important to move forward. We're also going to be following up with what I would call big ideas or new ideas to invite TRPA for opportunities. You know, sometimes we give comments on just those things we must have, but we're going to be moving to the next stage of innovative ideas and some big thinking things to provide them going forward that we think will help the basin. So we'll be doing that as well. I didn't want to take up too much time because I did want to give Tim Post an opportunity to make a presentation now to the board on the Barstow perchlorate investigation. I think it's very interesting.
Okay. Thank you very much. You're going to have to spring into action now.
I am.
And take the microphone. Good evening, Mr. Chairman and members of the board and ladies and gentlemen of the public. My name is Tim Post. I'm an engineering geologist in the Victorville office and the principal principal investigator on this project. I'm also a California registered geologist and a certified hydrogeologist. And just to give you a little background, get you oriented real quickly, you take off from here and head toward Las Vegas, you'll cross the Mojave River right here on the Mojave River Bridge. This is Soap Mine Road. You've probably heard a lot about that from another project. This is Old Highway 58, and this is Poplar Street right here. And our investigation area encompassed this area right here. And just to give you a little bit of background on how this project got started in November of 2010, the Marine Corps base, the MCLB here on the eastern part of town, as part of their routine sampling, they detected perchlorate in their water supply from Golden State Water above the maximum contaminant level. So they got a hold of Golden State. Golden State sampled the next day or so. They sampled all their production wells, and pretty quickly they determined that their problem well for the whole system was the Soap Mine Road well, which is about right in here. I don't have it marked, but it's about right in there. And so that well was taken off service. It's no longer in service, and they used their remaining wells to flush out the system. So I think things started on Friday, so by Monday they had the system flushed. They told everybody they could drink the water again, so everything got back to normal fairly quickly. So then in early December, about two weeks later, I think, regional board staff went out and actually canvassed the area. We didn't have a source here yet. We didn't know where it was coming from. So they went out and sampled 26 private wells in the area, and we only came up with two wells that were affected here on a river road. And those two residents are now being provided with bottled water. So they've got bottled water right now. Golden State service area is kind of odd. It's here in it's mostly in Barstow. It does extend down Soap Mine Road to about the gravel yard. But all the houses out in here are actually on private wells. There's a house there on private well. All these houses in here on private wells, and of course the ones that were affected here are too. Now, the source of the groundwater contamination was a mystery until not too long into all this. A former fire chief came forward and provided the regional board and US EPA a file about a company called Mojave Pyrotechnics Incorporated. And the turns out the actual pyrotechnics factory was over here. The owner lived here. He had four parcels here, and what we suspect, and strongly, actually what we know now, is he actually dumped quite a bit of perchlorate on the ground here in mid-1985. So we had a source area to begin with, and so later on in December, US EPA came back and actually did some soil sampling on this area and found significant perchlorate in the surface soils, right on the ground surface. So after some more discussion, US EPA agreed to do the soil investigation, and the Water Board agreed to do the groundwater investigation. So now as a result of this groundwater investigation, we did come up with a site investigation report that's now final, and the rest of this will be a briefing on what we found in our investigation. You have two pages of handout there, and one of them looks a lot like this. It's not quite the same. It's actually a lot better quality. And the other one is a groundwater contour map of the same information. When we started the investigation, we determined that based on cost alone, we decided to go with what was called temporary wells. These are not permanent monitoring wells, but we decided to put them in rows across the trend of what we thought was the plume. We had a source area here, and the Soap Mine Road contaminated well here, so we thought, well, this would certainly be the place to start. So we put a bunch of fences across that trend, and sure enough, these red dots are where we detected perchlorate. The green dots are where we did not detect perchlorate. These white symbols here are permanent monitoring wells that we split samples with the city of Barstow with. So those are permanent monitoring wells. All the rest of these are temporary wells that are where we just sampled the very top of the water table. We actually contracted URS Incorporated to do this work, to do the field work, the sample analysis, and the report writing. The field work for this project was performed in December 2011, and we went back and installed four more wells, sampled four more wells in May of 2012, and the final site investigation came out in April. Again, we'll go on to the next slide. This is the same information. It's about the same scale. This actually has all the data from the temporary wells on the plot. And the handout you have actually has all 26 locations. There's only 22 here, but I'll explain that in a minute. Of course, the maximum concentration we found was here, very close to the source area, to TW3 right there. Was 1,000 parts per billion. The one next to it was 13,000. TW2 was 13,000 parts per billion. So those are our highest concentrations. Our lowest concentration was actually down here at 1.2. That was at TW33. That was our last temporary well. The groundwater gradient, you might expect, is sub-parallel to the trend of the Mojave River channel. It's fairly flat there. The material is very porous, so you have a pretty flat groundwater gradient. The illegal dumping here on the site was thought to occur in mid-1985. So in 25 years, looks like the contamination has traveled about a mile and a quarter, which gives you kind of an idea of the groundwater or the contaminant velocity on the site. And we also think, even though most of the contamination is up here, these orange dash lines and yellow dash lines are a utility corridor. There's a water line, there's a Mojave Water Agency water line, and a Southwest Gas line. Actually, there are several gas lines in there. And we think this utility trench has something to do with this long tongue of contamination coming down here. We think if that wasn't there, all the contamination would still be up here, but I have yet to definitively prove that. So, and again, we went back in May, and on your handouts there, we actually went down and put one more location here. We put one more location here next. There was a house right here, so I put one between TW22 and the house, and that came back with a detected very low. I went out here to get a non-detect out here, and we actually punched a hole in between the highest concentration and the source area. And we went down about 15 feet below the top of the water table, and that sample came back, I think it was like 980, about 980. So the plume is at least 15 feet thick. We don't know exactly how thick it is, but it's at least that thick. So what are our next steps? Well, we're going to continue providing bottled water to the two affected households. We're going to continue monitoring the private wells and the monitoring wells in the area to see if there are any trends. And the U.S. EPA plans a soil cleanup of the source area either late this fall or next spring in 2013. And if you'd like to view the whole report, there's several perchlorate fact sheets, U.S. EPA site investigation report, and our report that I just told you about are all on Lahontan's website. So if you need that address, I can get that to you. So if you have any questions, I'd be glad to answer them.
Dr. Horn, any questions? Mr. Pumphrey?
Just to say that's really great.
Ditto. Mr. Diaz.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Is there anything more on the executive officer's report?
Yes, Laura Kemper was going to come up and update the board in terms of the quarterly enforcement violation report.
And I'm going to make this very quick. All right, your quarterly violations report is in your packet starting on page 4-49, and it covers the period from January 1st through March. I just wanted to let you know that we have a number of high-priority cases that we are working on active enforcement. One of those is at the top of your quarterly violations report, which is the Serenity Lodge, and it's a property up in the San Bernardino Mountains where a developer started doing construction without permits and rerouted a stream, intercepted a spring, and did some bulldozing without any proper dredge and fill permits or construction permits. So we issued a cleanup and abatement order that directed him to restore the stream and take a number of actions. He's met some of those requirements, but not all of them, so the Water Board's Prosecution Team Enforcement Committee is looking at additional enforcement actions that you will likely see in the future, on a future agenda. The Lake Arrowhead Community Services District has also identified there a couple of sewage spills that occurred that reached surface waters. We're looking at taking enforcement action on those, and we're also following up on a sewage spill that occurred in December of 2010 from the Lake Arrowhead CSD. We put them under a 13267 order to give us additional information about efforts they've been doing to prevent infiltration and inflow into their sewer line. They're actually under a pretty old cease and desist order by the Water Board to do that kind of work, so we were just checking in on their progress, and we expect that we'll be bringing future enforcement actions to the Board related to some of these sewage spills as well as their prevention activities. So that's something that you'll see in the next maybe early 2013, but we're continuing to pursue that. And then on the second page of your violation report, Levitt Lakes Community Services District is a small sewage treatment system in the Susanville area in Lassen County, and they have high nitrate in one of their monitoring wells, and we've issued a 13267 order. I just recently signed that, requiring some additional investigation and some improved monitoring methods, getting better information on groundwater elevation and the direction of flow and that type of thing. And that may result in future enforcement actions if we find out really what the source is and how they need to fix that. Things that are not on this quarter's violation report, but I wanted to mention, Mr. Norm Diaz talked about nursery products earlier today, and we definitely are looking at further enforcement actions on the violation of their waste discharge requirements. And I wanted to just let the board know that we did receive their construction quality assurance document just in the last week. So our staff did inspect the site and did observe that they were receiving waste materials. We think it's green waste, not sure that it's necessarily sewage sludge. So we're continuing to investigate that. At one of our inspections, we received their construction quality assurance document, which is the document that has their inspection results for the installation of their liners for their ponds and their pad. They've also installed their monitoring wells, so it has information about all of those things. We have to review that and accept it before they're authorized to receive waste, so that's the specific provision that they're in violation of right now, as well as before they were authorized to receive any waste at the site, they were required to have financial instruments, the bonds that Norm mentioned about closure bonds and cleanup bonds. We do not have any of that information in the office, so that's another specific violation. So those are things that we'll be looking at the best enforcement actions to take to get that remedied or to get the material removed from the site. We also, in the last month, have received some continued complaints from neighbors around the N&M dairy that's located in this general area. And that's a dairy that is under a couple of orders of the Water Board. They have a replacement water order where they provide bottled water to their neighbors. They also under a cleanup order to remove excess manure in the area from their dairy. and they are in violation of that cleanup order. They were making quite a bit of progress through about December, January, and then they have sort of fallen behind on their schedule, and they're definitely in violation of the schedule that was, they were supposed to complete that removal operation by this spring, and they have not done so. So we are looking at taking further enforcement actions against that theory. And I think that was, and then I know on your future board meetings next month in July, you'll be considering some enforcement actions against North Tahoe Public Utility District and the Spalding Tract, some of the residents there that failed to hook up to the community sewer system. And then we are also working on an enforcement action related to the Victor Valley Wastewater Authority for their sewage, for several sewage spills that occurred over like an 18-month period. So that's something you'll be seeing probably at your September board meeting. And I wanted to just, and I know that you're going to be having some future discussions about enforcement actions and priorities, and I wanted to just let you know a couple of things. One is that we have heard from the State Water Board's Office of Enforcement that they are planning to revisit some elements of the statewide enforcement policy, and there'll be an opportunity to provide public comments. So that, I've heard it's scheduled for kind of late in this calendar year. So just to, if you are putting your thoughts together, it'd be helpful to hang on to those or submit them. You know, this is a good time. And I wanted to remind the board that annually our enforcement staff puts together what we consider our enforcement priorities, and I wanted to just share those with you. There, we have three main priorities in terms of taking enforcement actions in the Lahontan region, and the first one relates to nitrate pollution in groundwater. That's a high priority in our region. We recognize we have several different areas in our region that are impacted by nitrate, and that is from either municipal wastewater treatment facilities, septic systems in some cases, dairies, landfills, not so much landfills, I'm sorry, mostly dairies and wastewater treatment facilities, and we have taken a focused strategy to deal with those nitrate discharges, and we've had kind of a three-prong approach where we address first human exposure, so we require replacement water, which we've been doing in a number of dairies, and then second, source control, which is dealing with the over-application of, say, wastewater or manure or that type of thing, and then third, looking at cleanup or remediation of the groundwater. So that is what we've identified as one of our high priorities, and included in that number one priority is also other forms of groundwater pollution. So the perchlorate problem that Tim just described, as well as the hexavalent chromium problem in Hinckley, also fall into that sort of category one of priorities, is essentially any place where we have evidence of pollution in groundwater that's actually affecting people's drinking water supplies, that's our number one priority is to address that. And then second, we're also aware that we have a number of municipal wastewater facilities in our region that are reaching the capacity of their facilities, and we're doing some investigation based on data that we have in the quarterly violation report that leads us to believe that they've got capacity or infrastructure problems. So where we're seeing effluent violations from lack of good treatment or enough, you know, treatment capacity, we're investigating those facilities and asking for more information, in many cases issuing or bringing cease and desist orders to the Water Board to require these treatment plants to improve their treatment. Atalanta would be an example of that, as well as we did some actions in the past at the Department of Corrections in Susanville. And then we've also been following up on the failure to submit monitoring reports or deficient monitoring reports, because the Water Board relies heavily on the self-reporting by dischargers and making sure that we have accurate information as well as timely reports. So that's another area that we've been following up on enforcement. And then I just wanted to let you know, too, that those are our top three priorities. Those are the things we're sort of focused on in a strategic sense. And then we deal with things that were brought up today, things like illegal discharges such as nursery products where there's a discharge occurring without authorization, Serenity Lodge. And then we also, as part of the statewide priorities, address sewage spills to surface water. So those are another set of enforcement actions that we've placed on the priority that you're seeing. And then without going into details, but just to think about it, is that we obviously use different tools, and some of that's described in the State Board's enforcement policy about kind of a progression of enforcement tools. We issue notice of violation versus when do you fine somebody, when do you require cleanup through a cleanup order. And so there's a number of considerations that are used internally to decide on, to decide how we're going to proceed. And usually it's about, you know, how do we get the outcome we want? You know, what's the best tool to use to try to get the outcome that we're after? But sometimes we use a number of those tools. Sometimes we can get that outcome with using only, you know, one or two of them. So I just wanted to share that, and I'm happy to answer any questions if you have any or want to provide me any direction on anything you've heard tonight or read in the in your packet.
Mr. Diaz, any questions? Mr.
Pumphrey? No, thank you.
Dr. Horn?
I would just like to say that was a very helpful report, and I think it's useful from time to time to review with the board the enforcement priorities, you know, so we
kind of
know what you're doing.
Yeah,
it's helpful to know.
Yeah, I appreciate that.
It's good to be reminded.
And I'd like to, and I think that may be something that we can work through. I know that I've been talking to Kim Niemar as well as attorneys with the Office of Enforcement about trying to get better direction on how we can have conversations, you know, where the Water Board members can provide some additional direction or input on priorities and on the types of enforcement actions that you think maybe are more effective, or, you know, you think we ought to use more of, or whatever. I think that we've been through a difficult period of learning this new process in terms of separation of functions, and I'm hoping that we can get some direction from Kim and the Office of Enforcement Attorneys on maybe some additional ways for us to talk about, you know, our priorities and future actions. And maybe it's in a general sense, you know, we can't necessarily talk a specific case, but that we can get some of your feedback and we can have some dialogue. So that we're hoping we may be able to schedule that in the future.
Thank you. Anything further on the safety officers report?
No, I think that's it, unless there's any questions. And to thank Lori for that presentation. We've been having some discussions about how we can help, you know, provide better guidance going forward in terms of enforcement. So thank you.
Well, we have a closed session and then reports from the board. We can take it in any order.
Why don't we do reports from the board?
Yeah. We have everyone here. Let's go to item 11, reports by Water Board Chair and board members. Dr. Horn.
Just wanted everyone to know that I had a conversation today with Jack Clark, who sends his regards to everybody, and he wishes he could be here. He has learned that he has to go through he's scheduled for surgery on July 27th. Then he has to go through a second round of chemotherapy, and then he will have a second surgery some months after that. So he's in for some more time of dealing with this. And he's hoping to be able to make our July meeting. So I guess, I mean, we're going to have to know, because otherwise we won't have a quorum on the NTPUD issue for July. But in any case, you know, he sounded tired, but I think he really appreciated a phone call. And so I would encourage anybody else who feels comfortable to pick up a phone and give him a call. And on a different note entirely, I seem to be the promoter of art these days. I just went to the Nevada Museum of Art in Reno. For anybody who happens to be near Reno, has a photography exhibit that's titled Oil. And I have to say, it's truly an impressive exhibit. This fellow, the photographs are blown up almost, I mean, they're like 4 feet by 4 feet, 5 feet by 5 feet, 6 feet by 6 feet. They are huge. And he has taken photographs of the oil industry from cradle to grave. And it's a pretty powerful exhibit. So if that interests you and you're near Reno, I encourage you to go see it.
Thank you. Mr. Pumphrey.
Nothing.
Hmm.
No report, thank you.
I don't have a report. Hopefully, Eric can. We may have a forum at our next board meeting.
But not on NTPC. He cannot vote on that. It's
so we may need to look at a teleconference, perhaps?
No. Well, I don't know.
No research.
And if I could add to that ever so slightly, if by some luck the budget is passed and the language goes through regarding the board's restructuring, your quorum will become four upon chaptering of the trail of bills.
Well, thank you. In that case, we'll go into closed session 5L. I believe that's the only item.
Personnel. And there was one other, Leviathan.
Right. And Leviathan.
Oh, you?